I'm Bill Castle, and this is Free Expression. This program is all about conveying the Christian message from a Catholic point of view and defending the liberty which makes it possible to do that. We talk with creative, interesting people about appropriate books for children and how corporations are pressured into promoting the woke agenda. Join us. Sit back and enjoy some free expression. Jeffrey Tucker is founder and president of the Brownstone Institute for Social and Economic Research. That's an organization devoted to understanding and addressing some of the more perplexing questions our society faces today. He's also a senior columnist for the Epoch Times, and he recently published a very compelling essay analyzing how American companies have chosen to promote ideas and images that alienate large portions of their customer base. Think of the Bud Light promotion with the colorful Dylan Mulvaney or Maybelline Cosmetics featuring other female impersonators to sell makeup, or any number of ad campaigns that seem to focus more on woke themes than they do on selling their products. It's all something of a mystery to me, and I think to a lot of other people, and Jeffrey Tucker is here to explore it. Thanks so much for being with us.
That's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Your essay focused on how pressure is brought to bear, both internal and external pressure, to coerce companies into doing things that often appear to be against their own business interests. Give us a little insight into how this is being done.
Well, under traditional capitalism, the decision makers in the economic realm are the consumers. What people buy determines what is produced. Consumer interests drives how decisions are made in terms of production, inventory, advertising, everything. Secondarily, the stockholders in public markets are the deciders. They're the owners of the company, but they in turn are responsible to consumers, and that system more or less works. Over the last 15 years, we've had another system in place that's gradually displaced that old structure, in which very large financial institutions, you know, like BlackRock and Fidelity, are the lenders and distributors of the stocks of very large companies. And these large companies are so leveraged out that they're highly dependent on what these financial firms tell them to do. And these firms have begun to promote policies that have nothing to do with consumers and nothing to do with stockholders. And they go under the name DEI, and which stands for diversity, equity, and inclusion, or ESG, which is society, governance, equality, you know, basically left-wing values, which fly in the face of the mainstream consumers of these things. So these large companies find themselves basically blackmailed by their own financial benefactors. And this is why they're so, why it's so strange that a company like Budweiser would not just come out and say, look, that was a dumb advertising thing we did promoting this fake transgender guy, and we apologize for consumers. They can't say that because they would endanger their financial portfolios and get them delisted from many of these large-scale index funds. So this is how it's happened, and it's been kind of creepy because, for the most part, capitalism has served the common person pretty well over many centuries. But in the 21st century, that's changed.
Perhaps it's naive on my part, but I would think eventually you reach a point where you simply can't function as a company or you can't be profitable, and the management has to draw a line and say, we just can't do this. Is that?
You're right about that, but that's all depends on consumer awareness. For the most part, we've kind of been taught to just blindly buy things that we think we want. We have not been, as a consuming public, very scrupulous about examining the values behind the products we buy. But now that the culture war has invaded the economic space, people are getting wise to these things. When Target started offering swimsuits for children that were designed for a non-existent transgender market, even its loyal customer base just decided they were not going to have it. They realized that, well, their favorite store of Target is actually the enemy. They're working for values that are contrary to their own. So once the consumers revolt, these companies do have to comply or they end up dying. And Bud Light is the paradigmatic case. It shows that consumers can have power, provided that they're made aware that their purchasing decisions can make a difference in industrial structures. And I would say that this is the most striking feature of our times, is that we have a newly awakened consumer. You can see how this is happening in the media and in the food and the product markets and everything across the board. You consider a movie like The Sound of Freedom, which came out recently. That movie was suppressed for the better part of 5 years.
Yeah.
And when it did come out, it came out through a kind of a guerrilla marketing campaign, mostly directed at Christians who, you know that there's something profoundly wrong with the world and wanted to know more about it. Well, it was fascinating to me just how the consumers actually drove that movie to be more successful than all the biggest Hollywood releases over the July 4th weekend. So that was a striking thing. And you're seeing this also even with Mark Zuckerberg try to compete with Twitter. Twitter, ever since Elon Musk took over, has been a really a place for free speech. And Zuckerberg didn't like that because he was a major censor, a source of censorship during the COVID years. So when he released his competitor to Twitter, all the big media said, oh, this is wonderful. Finally, he's cool again. Everybody go to his new thing called Threads. Well, the Wall Street Journal this morning reports that there's been a 70% decline in user engagement. So that new product cannot survive if people don't use it. I don't care how many big shots in government and big finance are backing it. So you're right. But it all depends on the consumers becoming aware of what they're doing. And I think that's what's happening now.
And that, of course, is made difficult by something else that many corporations have been cooperating in, and that is the censorship and cancellation thing. Companies have given themselves over. They've colluded with government agencies. How do we get around that?
This is a more difficult problem because it's being handled in the courts right now, but there's no easy path from here to there. Robert F. Kennedy testified yesterday in the House committee hearing and decried censorship and said, you know, that it's wrong, contrary to American values. You can't live as a democracy without free speech. And incredibly, the Democrats tried to take the entire session to executive session and block the public from watching it.
Yes, I saw that.
That was voted down. But the New York Times, in reporting on what happened yesterday in the committee, said the hearing dealt with thorny questions such as whether the First Amendment also protects misinformation. Okay, that is not a thorny question.
It does seem that the market is responding. We've seen the emergence of some alternative marketing firms like this Public Square, which has just done a stock offering, I understand. They direct people to other kinds of vendors who don't follow woke policies. Do you see this as a real viable movement, as something that will grow?
I do, and I think it's the most exciting and most hopeful development of our time. As I say, for the consuming public to become aware of the values that they're supporting when they're spending their money, that is really a path towards changing the world. You know, we only vote once every 4 years or every 2 years, and a lot of times our vote doesn't really matter. But every day in the marketplace, you're voting. You're voting to make this product, make more of this product, make this company survive. And you don't have to boycott. Just don't buy from companies whose values you disagree with. It's pretty simple. It's very peaceful. But it's a way to restructure the world all around us. We've seen a big waking up on the part of the American consumer public. And this comes after 3.5 years in which people have been treated so brutally by their governments and by government's allies in the media and technology companies that people are determined that they're never going to let this happen again. And they want ways to make a difference in shaping the world and bringing back a good society. And what they've discovered is that you can make a difference through your purchases and how you handle your personal finances. And it doesn't take a whole lot to make a difference. We've seen this in the Bud Light case. That's why I find it so exciting, because it's just a great demonstration that once consumers wake up, they can actually make the difference between a company doing well and actually going under. And in the case of Bud Light, I feel almost certain that that whole brand will be decommissioned. But it also could go further. It could actually drive Anheuser-Busch to the stockholders to throw out the management, fire the CEO, and maybe we'll have a new management, or maybe they'll just decide to sell it, or maybe it's permanently damaged. We'll see. But that's an amazing thing to go from the number one beer to being number 10 or whatever it's dropping to now, to the point that financial pressure is reporting this morning that the beer is not even being purchased at restaurants and bars. So that's extraordinary.
Well, as you say, it takes awareness, but it also takes a willingness on the part of people to change their buying patterns, to inconvenience themselves, to abandon products that they have consumed for a long time. How do we get people to be willing to make those kinds of personal changes?
Well, it's gradual, and it's a process of education, but it's happening through many channels all over the country, through alternative media, and also a growing sophistication on the part of people. You know, I used to listen to National Public Radio every day, and I always thought it had a, you know, as people say, a liberal bias, but it didn't bother me that much because I thought that it was basically fair, and I would say the same thing about the New York Times. I don't believe that anymore. I've personally sort of become aware, and now I listen to NPR just to see what propaganda sounds like, you know? And it's very obvious to me. Something happens in your mind, you know, once you become suspicious, you lose trust. And when you lose trust, you get curious, you know, why are they saying what they're saying? How come they're not reporting on something you saw in an alternative venue and so on? So your framework for understanding the world begins to change. And instead of just going through life in a sleepy daze, you suddenly become active in what media you listen to and what books you read and what websites you go to and what products you buy at the store.
Do you see the church as having a role in this? I mean, these woke issues are at their core fundamentally moral questions.
Well, so the church is essential here. Unfortunately, for many of the hierarchies and all the mainstream denominations, they all went along with the COVID thing.
Yeah.
And it's particularly outrageous that even the Vatican canceled Holy Week during 2020. I mean, it's an incredible thing to realize that the Catholic Church actually went along with this stuff. And they did it for very confused reasons. Basically, they put social acceptance above the edification of the faithful or the praxis of the faith. You know, and I think we're going to need some big apologies. And that's beginning to happen. I know the Archbishop of New York is inching more and more towards apologizing for that. But we need a coming to terms with what's happened to us over the last 3 years for the church to regain its credibility and provide some leadership, which we desperately need.
Tell us a little bit about the Brownstone Institute. What do you guys do?
Well, we were founded in the wake of this crisis to provide some clarity about all sorts of issues, from public health to economics to the issues of censorship and technology, to help understand the world in a better way. And I founded Brownstone because I was frustrated that there wasn't a venue out there that had a sort of totality of understanding about the depth of the crisis, which is indeed very extreme, much less the solutions. I opened up this venue just for research and discussion and publishing, and it's been an enormous success just because people are so hungry for an alternative way to understand our times.
And where can people find out about your work?
You can go to brownstone.org. I have a new article up this morning about the censorship problem, but we have something close to 1,500 articles there now and 20 different social media platforms. I guess we've published now 6 books, and we're holding conferences around the country, our big conference in November in Dallas. So I appreciate anybody who can gain information from what we publish, and any support is always appreciated too.
Jeffrey Tucker, founder and president of the Brownstone Institute for Social and Economic Research. Thanks for taking time to talk about this. This is an important issue of our time, and people have got to be aware.
I agree, and I appreciate very much the chance to talk.
Patty McGuire Armstrong is what you might call a presence in the world of religious communication. You've seen her on EWTN, you've heard her voice on numerous Catholic radio stations, and you've probably read at least one of her many books. An area of special interest for her is communicating with young people. Her Dear God books, for instance, help kids find answers to some of their biggest questions about faith and life. These works are key offerings in the Holy Heroes collection available on the web and through Catholic bookstores across the country. As you would guess, Patty has thought deeply about touching the hearts and minds of the young. Those hearts and minds can be touched with positive messages, but also with information that can cause confusion, misdirection, even sin. She's here to talk about today's kids' book scene. Patty, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Bill, for having me on.
Kids are reading a lot of very disturbing stuff these days, books for young people. At least the material that's coming from the major publishers tend to have a leftward perspective politically. They feature stories of people who are deeply confused about sex and gender, and they're often strongly critical of traditional religion and Western culture. Why is it, do you think, that KidLit has gone in this problematic direction?
Well, there's obviously an agenda, and it's not from God. I have a TV talk show, Ladies of Another View, and I've covered some of the legislation that we've passed in North Dakota this year, not allowing the pornographic material that grooms children to be in the juvenile section of libraries.
Right.
And these books are showing up in school libraries. Some of them have photographs that you can't put on TV, and yet you can give them to children. Somebody that I work with, who was the producer of the show, her 12-year-old came home with a book. They were just having family conversation, and she said she had a book report to do. And she said, oh, it's something about Hurricane Katrina. And they pick it up, and they realize, yeah, Hurricane Katrina was mentioned, but the main character of the book is experimenting with different sexual experiences. So they went to the school. I think the assistant principal just said, well, if your child isn't mature enough for this book, that's her issue, that's your family issue. But no, then the superintendent said, no, we're going to take this off the shelf. The stuff that the kids are reading is because the parents are either allowing it or the adults are pushing it. That's what's going on. So we need to be proactive and get the high-quality reading in the hands of our children. And we need to read with them. We need to start reading to them when they're young. We can't just, like, I go to rummage sales. I see a lot of books that were never cracked open. I know the parents think, oh, I'll just buy them and give it to them, but, you know, maybe we need to go that next step.
It's really kind of a chicken and egg situation in a way. I mean, does this originate with the publishers? Is it the schools who were pushing this, or is it just the parents not being aware? I mean, you know, it's a very complex kind of round-robin situation, it seems to me.
It is. I'm old enough that I have observed this unraveling. You know, first you took prayer out of schools. So Jesus is not welcome, but drag queens are. Now, I know a lot of your listeners, maybe they homeschool, maybe they send their kids to Catholic school, but Catholic school is not a safe haven. You have to be vigilant still, because the devil never sleeps, and he's always trying to get a toehold and look through those openings. So we need to pay attention. Gone are the days where we thought we could entrust our children to the schools. And I think we were asleep. We thought we could. The world had changed. And you thought teachers, sisters, Catholic schools, public schools, you thought these are good places. They care for our kids. We can trust them. They're the experts. And then, especially during COVID, when parents started to pay attention and look what was going on, they all of a sudden started showing up to school board meetings, and they came to realize that they are often at odds with the teachers and the school boards, who see them as domestic terrorists if they don't want this kind of stuff being shoved down their kids' throats.
Right.
Where are the good, high-quality books, literature? Where's the history? You know, all of it is being redone, and there's so much going into our children's lives that shouldn't be there. They need to be innocent. They need to be enjoying childhood. And when you confuse them and you put this bad stuff in, and it's all been, you know, you got prayer out of school, you got Jesus out of the way, then you start pushing And before you know it, you wake up and you can't believe what is being handed to our children. And now how many generations have been brainwashed so that some people think this is civil rights? But it's like you look at some of these books. We had somebody in North Dakota who decided to take this on, looked at some of the books in the library, in the juvenile section. He sent them to the legislators, and he said, do you think this is okay? Well, my goodness, it's not okay. Like I said, you can't say some of the words. You can't put it up on TV, and it has no business in the hands of children. This isn't just like a bunch of prudes not wanting the kids to know the birds and the bees. Like, no, this is the kind of stuff that makes adults blush. Like, what?
Yeah.
You got these pictures of adults doing all kinds of things. You never even heard of some of it. Anyways, not to go to the dark side. We have to get away from the dark side and move into the light.
Well, what can parents do? I mean, we've seen demonstrations at school boards. We've seen people charged with being terrorists or trying to undermine public education, all of these wild charges that have been launched just because people object in a perfectly reasonable way. Do you see a way to organize some kind of resistance to this that might be effective?
I really like Parents Defending Education. It's an organization that takes these fights on, that oftentimes takes them to court. So it's a bigger organization, network with like-minded parents, pay attention to what is going on in schools, and get good Catholic books. You know, my books, Dear God, I Don't Get It, and Dear God, You Can't Be Serious, and I'm working on the third one. I don't know what the title will be of that one, but really, it's a way to draw kids in. Now, I wrote with Jeff Cavins and Matt Pinto the Amazing Grace series, which was best-selling books. I just won three first place awards for What Would Monica Do? And what I consistently do is draw people in with stories, make things engaging. Now, my Dear God book series is fiction based on real life events inspired by true events in our own family and true characters. I don't lecture. I draw people in through the story. I make it engaging. Through the story, through lived experiences, and that's like in the Amazing Grace books, they were like Chicken Soup for the Soul,
right.
Published by Ascension. You drew people in so that, like, sometimes when I edited the stories, every time I went through them, I would cry because they were that emotional. But I didn't put a little lesson at the end. I didn't need to, and I had a real radar because I was also the managing editor and I ghostwrote more than half the stories. And any time there was a little lecture at the end explaining what the lesson was, if you didn't figure out the lesson in the story, it was not written correctly. Because when you have a transformation, which my children's book, there's a transformation that we all go through. They're not lessons just for kids. They're lessons that some adults are still working on or lessons that we need to over and over, like when our prayers aren't answered. Well, gee, why should we even bother to pray? We prayed so hard and God said no, or here I'm praying for this, but somebody else is praying for the exact opposite. What's the point of doing that? And the main character in Dear God, I Don't Get It, Aaron, is feeling like, what is the point of prayer at all? It doesn't make any sense. I didn't want to have to move. You know, my dad lost his job. Here we were not missing Mass anymore and taking our religion more seriously, and that didn't help us at all. But at some point, he feels lonely and realizes, I don't understand all this, but I'm going to stay connected to God. So he goes through his trials, and he comes to realize that God's plan includes things we don't know. We don't know everything. And sometimes he has a bigger plan for us. And then with Dear God, You Can't Be Serious, the family decides to homeschool. But it's not a book like for homeschoolers. It's for everybody. And Luke is like, no way. And that was kind of like our real life experience. I homeschooled for 19 years, but then all our kids went to the Catholic high school. So I don't just have one perspective. It's very funny. They're humorous. And life can be humorous. My kids are humorous. At least I chose to laugh instead of, you know, wringing my hands sometimes. In that if you look at life in that way, you don't stress yourself out too much, and you walk with the Lord, and you get through some difficult, confusing times, but in the end, you see that God has more to offer you than you can give yourself.
Well, that's a crucial lesson, and we need stories. We need that's how kids learn. That's how we make sense out of life. They're absolutely essential to forming us as human beings. Tell us, where can people find out more about your books and other good children's literature that's out there?
Holy Heroes, holyheroes.com. They do a fantastic job putting out good, high-quality Catholic materials. They just came out with a book on Carlos Atuas that has writings from his mother, full of photographs, and I would say that's for all ages. I feel like, you know, the Dear God book series with you, that I've had teenagers read it, that I've had adults tell me they loved it, that kids are reading it over and over, that you can go there. They're brightly colored materials. They have like a mass kit. They have rosary devotions that, especially for parents that maybe are either converts or weren't well catechized, I would highly recommend going to Holy Heroes. And I know there's other good Catholic publishers too. You know, like I've Ascension, I've published with Ascension Press,
right,
and Scepter Publishing. So, you know, look for those good quality, but be aware of what is in the books. That it, you know what, if you have Good News Book Fair, Liz Letigua is a friend of mine, and she did that to counteract the Scholastic Book Fairs. Do not trust Scholastic. Some of you may have fond memories being a kid and coming home with your little Scholastic book orders. Yeah, but don't trust them. And then the nice thing about Good News Book Fairs, they have screened all the books. They've gone through all of them. So, you know, sometimes a book cover looks fun, got some great illustrations, it sounds like an engaging story. But unless you read it yourself, you don't know what might be slipped in there that's not good for our kids.
Patty McGuire Armstrong, hey, thank you very much. This is very useful guidance. It's something that parents need to be more aware of. They need to take the initiative in finding out what their kids are reading. I appreciate your guidance. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for the work that you're doing, Bill, getting the word out. We're just all trying to bloom where we're planted, right?
Be with us next time when we explore other aspects of religious communication and look deeper into the great Christian heritage of free expression. Free Expression with Bill Castle is a production of Good Shepherd Catholic Radio and Company Publications, where good books, good music, and good radio are always good company. Dan Kuras provided technical assistance. Theme and incidental music are by Dan Adam. The program was produced and directed by Bill Castle. This is Good Shepherd Catholic Radio.